accession number 11281, reel 2.
Mr. Kelly, reel 2.
And as I say, most of them were conscripts. And when we got through the door, him being a tall chap and a very well made lad, there was a sergeant in the Irish Guards standing in the doorway. And a big man, he said, right, now lads, he said, what do you want to do? So he said, I'm joining the Royal Marines. So we both said we were joining the Royal Marines. So I wasn't going to go, I had no intention of joining anything else. And that's the only reason I went along to join. So he said, he gave us the spiel about the Royal Marines not being a very good unit, not like the Guards. And the Guards being the par excellence of units. And even when we went into action, we would have the last rites before we went. That didn't do very much to encourage us to join them, seeing as he needed the last rites. Anyway, we refused him, and he was very persistent. Then when we got into the booth, which was the Admiralty booth, we had the same thing with the Navy fellow. A chief petty officer in the Navy, although I didn't know he was a chief petty officer at the time, but it turned out to be a chief petty officer. There were no Marines recruiting people there. And he wanted us to join the Navy. So finally we got our way and we joined the queue. And gradually we, various states of undress, we proceeded along these little things and we called in with our little cards. And called in and we asked to stand on our tiptoes, to bend over, to do all sorts of things. And I often wonder, since from that day, why do you have to be A1 to get shot? Surely it would be better to keep the fit men. Anyway, we arrived back, or I arrived back, because there would have been so many people, and you could either go left or right and into these different cubicles. And by the time you had your eyes tested, your teeth done and everything else, and your blood pressure, you arrived back, you were well separated. So I arrived back in the Admiralty cubicle, and he said, right, give me a card. So I gave him a card, so he said, oh, right, he said, you've passed. So he said, no, he said, what about the Navy? So he had another go at me to join the Navy, and I refused. So I said, no. So then, if I passed, I said, I'm joining the Royal Marines. So I signed up for the Royal Marines. Now, my friend, I was outside then, ushered outside, finished with. I was nailed in that then. And my friend, no sign of him. So I had to, because of the crowd, I had to get out of the way and get more towards the front door where we'd come in. And eventually he arrives with me, you know, so. And his face is black as thunder. So he's storming out the door. I said, well, where are you going, sonny? Just a minute, hang on. So I said, how'd you get on? So he just stormed out, and right up to the sergeant and the guards. And he said, right, he said, I'll join the guards, the Irish guards. So that left me aghast. I thought, what's this? So I grabbed him, and I said, what do you mean you'll join the guards? I said, I've joined the Royal Marines. I said, I wouldn't have joined anything only for you. So he said, I'm joining the Guards. So I said, well, why didn't you do that on your own? I said, you could have come down. We're really blazing. And, of course, I had to look up for two of you, see. But that didn't deter me. I would have, you know, I felt like hitting him straight in the face, really. But the Guards of side said, well, he said, why didn't you join the Royal Marines? So he said, well, he wouldn't have me. He said, I've got fallen arches. So I thought, I was wavering, I was. I got mad. And the guards said, fella, changed completely then. He said, I'm sorry, son. He said, you're no good to the guards either. He said, but you, what about you? He said, you can change your mind, you know. And I said, don't you talk to me. Don't any of you talk to me. And I stormed out. And I was, it's mad. And the feeling of depression that came over me was fantastic. And then I thought, I've still got to face my father. What am I going to tell him? Well, as it happened, the Marines didn't call you up immediately. They left, well, they didn't call me up immediately, and they left me. And it was supposed to be to have a squad all the same height, something like that, you know, I don't know, really. But anyway, it was about, it must have been 4 or 5 months before I got, the papers came through. And I'd forgotten all about it. I'd put it out of my mind, I thought, oh, they must have forgotten, you know, no chance. But one night, I arrived home from work, and my mother was there, and she said, she had this envelope. On Her Majesty's, on His Majesty's service. She said, what's this? So I said, oh no. She said, what are you going to tell your father? And she didn't even open it. But she knew what it was. And I hadn't opened it either. So she said, you better be have a good excuse. So I said, oh. And my heart was in my boots. I was absolutely down. Opened it up, and inside was the travel warrants and all the thing, and instructions for joining, and when to go. So my father walked in, and my mother said to him, she said, Jimmy's got a bit of news for you. She said, he's been called up. Never even looked up. And my father was a short man. And the only one of the family who takes after him is my youngest brother, Billy. We were all taller, much taller than him. And the brother next to me, next youngest to me, he is a 6 foot man as well. So he didn't look up on this occasion, and he just said from where he was sitting at the table, he said he didn't get called up. Said he's volunteered. He said they're not calling the 18-year. He said he's got another couple of years to go yet before they call him up. He says they've got to get rid of the, and they were, I think they were calling the 23s up or something like that, 21, 22s, whatever they were, you know. Anyway, that's how I came to join the Royal Marines. And but once I joined them. And once I got my father's blessing, because he didn't keep it up, he only held out for a matter of an hour or so. And once he'd finished his meal, he just said, "You did join up, didn't you?" I said, "Yes, I did." I had to admit it. So he said, "Right." He said, "Just wait, I get changed." He says, "So he gets changed." He says, "Come on." He said, "I'll buy you your first pint." And he shook me out. So and I didn't drink and I didn't smoke. And I didn't drink and smoke for long enough while I was in the Marines. I still don't smoke either now. But I didn't feel too bad after that. As a matter of fact, I looked forward to it then. And I didn't regret it.
What was the training like?
The training was excellent as far as I was concerned, because I was only a young man. And if you appreciate the time in the country's depression time, there was nothing for anybody to do here. There were no stadiums, and there were no places where you can go like there are now. And there was very little to do, although the city was much lively with shows and that, rather than clubs as it is now. But then, of course, that needed money. You needed money for that, and there wasn't a great deal of that about. Until the war started, of course, And then, of course, job became plentiful. But then there was no men to work. That's why it became plentiful, I think. Women were more and more recruited into the employment rather than men. So it wasn't a very good time. And we had a bit of a hard life, because my father and everybody else was also out of work in the 1930s. And, you know, there was no dole as they get now. There was what they call the parish. That was a handout, if you qualified for it. And then there was different things like that. But you lived on bread and jam, and there were no luxuries, most certainly no luxuries, and there was nothing you could spend any money on, or anything that cost any money, you just couldn't have. So it was a rough time. And of course, the houses that we lived in, it was an outside toilet. Now, we didn't know any difference. An outside toilet down the yard was a good house. And one cold water tap in the entire house over a mug and sink. That was the set thing. So when I went into the Marines, and I went into their barracks with hot and cold water and showers and baths, and the meals, I was getting what? A breakfast, dinner, tea and a supper. It was fantastic life. And all they were asking me to do was to march around on a parade ground for 3/4 of an hour, and then go physical training for 3/4 of an hour, then go learning all about guns for 3/4 of an hour, everything done on a 3/4 of an hour basis, or something of that nature. So it was absolute heaven to me.
Could you cope with what they asked you to do?
Oh yes, there was no problem. I said, I don't think I was thick. It sort of just fell in my way, and I liked the idea of being smart.
But could you cope physically with the demands of the drill and the PT and so on?
Oh yes, the only thing that I always remember, mind you, that wasn't that may not have been a fault of my physique. I quickly built up, I think, when I was there. You know, I went from and I was still growing. I was 5'8" when I went into the Marines, and I ended up 5'10½". And I had not a very big chest, but I ended up with a 40 chest, and a 12 stone 6 weight, which never varied, and I'm still 12 stone 6 today. But the things that got me, and I think it was mostly I've got a fair sense of humour like anybody else, and little things tickle my fancy, you know, at different times. And the only thing that I couldn't do, the PT, loved it. The marching around on the playground, no problem at all. The route marches, I used to walk to town here, without any thought, and walked everywhere here. So walking was not no hardship to me. And I just fell just right for me, nicely, except the bayonets. Now the bayonet fighting, I didn't mind. Where you they give you a stance to adopt, and the way to hold the bayonet and how to thrust with the bayonet and things like this. There was a bit of an art to fighting with a bayonet in those days. Although the Germans didn't bother about it, you know, they just shot you where you stood, 400 yards away, with your bayonet all poised. Well, they never bothered fixing this. They just shot you from a distance, which was far more effective actually than the bayonet. But they used to make you stand there for an awful long time, and you stood with what you know, say. Well, in my case, my left knee bent, and crouching like that, and you were on the ball of your foot. And if there was any lengthy discussion where he was correcting one man, and he was in a big circle around him, the PTI he was, and he was saying, like, get your, to hold that rifle up and to maintain it, to not put a strain on your muscles, and your muscle begins to quiver. And my left leg used to quiver, and I used to feel it trembling with the strain of just holding that position. And eventually it made me chuckle, you know. That was that sort of it wasn't that it was hurting me, it was just that. And for some, and that caused me more trouble by just smiling or chuckling like that. They took it as an insult to the instructors, and they'd make me run all over the place with this. at the high port, and then it'd make me do extra bits of thrusting with the bayonet. And the second thing about bayonets was that they had a simulated bayonet training area where you were in slit trenches. In trenches, rather, just like the 1914 war. And you jumped out of them when they blew a whistle. And getting out was bad enough. That's the very little to get up. And there was a, you know, just, I could always just see over the top of it. And they expected you to just jump straight out and charge down the field, the stretch of grass. And they had dummies in various positions on the ground and hanging up. And you had to stab one standing up. And you just have to go right into him. And you pull it back out of here and stab the fella on the ground and then run on and jump into their trench, you see. And in their trench, they'd have the dummies in the trench, you see, and you were to bayonet at them every time you jumped out. Now, when you started that training, you did not use your own rifle and bayonet. You used the rifles and bayonets that they kept in the gymnasium for that purpose. Now, these rifles and bayonets were not quite the same as the ones we were issued with. They were the old 1914, the Enfields, with the 18-inch bayonets, or similar to the 18-inch bayonet on the end. So, I suppose one bayonet, a rifle and bayonet is as good as the next rifle and bayonet, except the wear and tear on the thing. And every time I did everything, that's perfect. I got out of that trench. I went charging down there, screaming my head off. I stabbed that poor fella straight off. Then I got his mate on the ground. No problem at all. Jumped straight on him, dragged the bayonets out, charged on, and straight into this trench. And every time I went into that trench, I ended up with a bayonet bent. It went in the dummy. And whatever it hit at the back of it, or whatever way I had my weight, I bent it. And, of course, he used to drag me out of the trench and he, come out, look at this. And I'd be a laughing stock in front of everybody, standing there with this bayonet curled over at the top. Well, I couldn't help laughing at it myself. And it's, you know, because I could see the humorous side of it, me standing there, and it tickled me to think, and that didn't do me any good at all. That just got me extra drills again. So I was there again at 6 o'clock at night, running around when everybody else was relaxing. I was running around with a rifle and bayonet. So that was the only part of the training that began, in the end, to give me a little bit of nightmare. Only because of that.
This was at Limston, was it?
I went to Limston, which was disappointing to me, because and my papers showed that I was a volunteer. I wasn't a conscripted man, you see. And I thought I'd go to Portsmouth, and then I would eventually be on board ships. But that didn't take place. I was put in this draft to Limston, and I went to Limston. And but as I say, while I was there, that was the only I enjoyed the training, and it didn't matter to me at all. But it did matter when I couldn't come home looking like my brother did. In his blue uniform and all polished up and things like that. Although my kit was just as good as his. But I wore a battle dress and not a blue suit. I was never issued with the blues, which is a bit of a disappointment to me.
So after you'd done your recruits training, you were in the Marines for quite some period before you became a Royal Marine Commander.
That's right, yes.
What kind of duties did you have then?
Well, when I completed my initial training, I went to for further training to a place just outside Portsmouth called Havant. And we, you know, continued your field training then, which is entirely different to the training that you've been doing this time. You did get mucky and you learned how to dig holes in the ground and all that sort of stuff. And then I was sent to a unit run by a Picton Phillips, who was a bit of a harum-scarum type of fellow, a colonel. And he would certainly a very strange ideas about war. But mind you, in retrospect, I think that his ideas were far better, and I learnt more from that fella's thoughts. Maybe not from his actions, but from his ideas, and for him to sow the seed in my mind of what warfare really was, or modern warfare really was, the type of warfare that we were going to have to fight against the Germans. Now, all our training had been geared on 1914, up to that point. And when he suddenly started taking us out into the field and marching us en bloc and then opening fire with machine guns from high ground, shooting right across the top of your head, it had everybody looking at one another saying, crackpot, idea is this. But that was essential for you to get used to the idea that bullets can... And if you can hear them cracking over your head, they're not going to hit you. Not that you ever think that deeply about it. I mean, you know, everything's going to hit you when you're at the time. If you can sit down and think about it, there's that reassuring fact that if you can hear them cracking above your head, they're not coming at, they're not aimed at you. But it did give you the effect, and then he started using explosive as well to give you some idea of what mortar fire and shell fire was like. And I don't think everybody assimilated that sort of thing. And they just, it was put down to his being a sentry in some way.
What rank did he have? A colonel?
Colonel, yes. Well, in actual fact, I put a bullet in the back of his car one time, because when he was sentry duty at night, we had live ammunition then, of course. We issued live ammunition because there was still a threat of perhaps, you know, maybe an invasion or something like that occurring. So everybody was issued with live ammunition. And as a sentry at night, your rifle was loaded and one up a spout. And he came flying in this night in his Humber car and turned up the path. And he didn't stop. And my friend who was on duty with me had called halt, and he ignored it, so I fired at it. And the next morning we were on parade, and he wanted to know who fired the shot at the back of his car.
Did you run up?
I had to in the end, yeah, because he threatened everybody. I wasn't going to run up to begin with. Phew, I didn't know the answer. Oh no, it was only when he threatened everybody, you see, with the punishments there. I'll have to do it otherwise. I'll get battered off them, wouldn't I? So I had to own up. So he congratulated me. He said, well, what? He said, there's nothing for you to be afraid of, he said. And you do that every time, he said. Any time, he said, doesn't matter who it is, if they go flying through and don't stop, you let them have it. So that was advice from somebody here, brained as it.
How did you join the Royal Marine Commandos then?
Well, while I was with Picton Phillips, as a matter of fact, there was a call for hazardous duties. Now, at the time, I didn't know anything about commandos, and I don't think anybody ever heard of the name. Because at that time, they went under the name, I believe, of special companies. The word commando hadn't been tagged to them at that time. if it had, it had only been recent. But they weren't generally known as commandos then. And I thought, well, that I joined up to fight, and I don't know whether I'd like it or not, but I certainly liked to have a go. And I was getting bored with the training all the time. Mind you, by that time the training had changed quite a bit. The landing craft had started to come, and we'd been using landing craft, and we'd done long marches, and it looked as though you were building up to something. So there was always the thought that we were fast becoming an active service unit. But however, that's how I came to get in the commando, and then one day, out of the blue, a long time after I'd volunteered, they just said, pack your bags. So I said, just, there was another chap, a fellow named Charlie Hall, who came with me. And we went to a little camp somewhere in the south of the country, not too far away, but more inland from where we were on the coast, which at the time I think we were on a place called Hayling Island. We'd been to Wales and we'd been up to Scotland training and things like that, and we ended up down there. Anyway, we went to this camp, and we were mixed up with army chaps, and from all different regiments. And they had a very, there must have been about maybe 100 of us to begin with, and they whittled us down to about 24 or something like that. Process of elimination, and nobody knew what it was for. Nobody said anything to you. Nobody said what you were doing. I didn't even know it was because I volunteered for hazardous duties. And nobody would speak to you, you know. They just said, when we spoke to these chaps, they only wore a cap comfortably. They didn't wear a beret or any helmet, a hat of any sort, and any badge. They just wore a cap comforter. What they call the cap comforter. It was a kind. It was actually issued to you as a scarf. You just put it around your neck. You see, it was a long. It was it's about that long, just enough to go around your neck.
About 2 feet long.
That's right. Yeah. And what you did, you opened it. It was doubled. You see, and you just opened it and you pushed one end through until it touched the other end, so that you had, and then you folded it back, and it just sat on your head. Then, you know, it's a nice little skull cap, you know, and a woolly skull. And everybody wore them then, until you got your green beret. And then they had a little ceremony of taking that off and throwing it in a waste paper basket or ditching it somewhere and giving you the green beret when you passed the course. And that's that. They just eliminated you by a variety of methods. Some were eliminated from their records when they arrived. But we were only there for a couple of weeks. And in that time, they'd whittled us down from 100 down to a very small number. And that's how I came to get into the commando. And the next thing was I was put into 4-1 commando, which wasn't a very very pleasant thing to me, actually, because I went there with my friend Charlie Hall, who came from Newcastle. And when we got to 4-1 commando, we were immediately split up and put with two different sections, you see. And we both went to A Troop. But the formation of a commando at that time, they had four fighting troops and a heavy weapons troop. Now, in each troop, I was in A, we went to A Troop. And each troop consisted of about 65 men. It was a very high-powered unit in itself. It was smaller than an army company and twice as large as a normal army platoon, which normally had about 33 men in it. Now, you had a captain, two lieutenants. You had about 7 or 8 sergeants. And umpteen corporals, but no lance corporals. If you did a job, you got paid for it. And lance corporal never gets paid. And they did, and anybody did the job anyway. So within the section, instead of having, say, about 7 or 8 men, you had about 12 or more. And you had 4 men in the gun group. The Bren gun had 4 men. And